been put on last because I'm an engineer and the density of mathematics is rather low, lower than other people's. So I quite like to talk about dimensionality reduction techniques, but also talk a little bit about machine learning and what how we're applying it. So I've been really quite interested in some of the talks this afternoon. As you'll see, my SVD is a very simple SVD. So we deal with medical data, and rather than being hugely high dimensional, there's lots. It can be 1, 2, 3, 4 dimensional. There is lots of it, and there can be multiple streams of it, so different types of data. So we deal a lot with both images and time series. I'm going to talk a bit more about time series. And often what we'd like to do is diagnose abnormalities or normality, or at least predict changes. So can we see whether there's a deterioration or improvement, any signs of this? So we have, if you can actually extract it from hospitals, which is not trivial, you have large amounts of data, 100 hertz or higher. The EEG data I have is sometimes sampled at 2,500 hertz, because they want particularly to pick out various features, and 100 hertz just isn't good enough. So we somehow need to extract features or reduce the dimensionality in an unsupervised, preferably in an unsupervised fashion. Now, I say that, but do we? Maybe we can just give it to a neural network and let it sort it out. So I'd like to look at some of these questions. So big thing at the moment is machine learning, as you all know. Extremely popular. People have applied it to medical data. People are applying it to medical data. Now, one criticism that is that machine learning techniques fail to generalize. So you can train it on your data set, and you actually apply it to a slightly other a new data set. You don't know how to normalize your data, you don't know how to pre-process your data, it falls in a heap. So clinical practitioners have they're very skeptical about machine learning for sort of real diagnoses, as they should be, really. But there's a new generation of machine learning systems that actually are starting to give the user some idea of how they're learning. So I don't know what it's like in the maths department, but if you want to offer a student project, you put machine learning in the title, and they're queuing up outside your door. So this is a big thing with student interest, certainly in engineering at the moment. But I'm going to start with non-machine learning. So what I have been doing for some years is effectively SVD, but I'm going to think about how I do my SVD in terms of tensor decomposition, and reduce the dimensionality of my problem via these SVD techniques. Particularly, they give high performance generally, especially for certain types of time series data. So just so that everybody knows that I'm doing the simplest thing possible, I'm going to, if I take an SVD, split it into U, sigma, V, where U and V are my orthogonal matrices, and sigma is my singular value, positive and in decreasing order, as we saw from the first talk. The singular value spectrum tells you a lot about whether you'll be able to reconstruct your data with a few singular values. So unlike the molecular modeling data, I can generally reconstruct it from a few modes, and those modes tend to be quite important for classification. So I can classify. So just let me go through this quickly, just to my nomenclature will be my columns of V are mapped on to columns of U via the singular values. So it's kind of an eigen, it's a it's like an eigen decomposition for non-square matrices. We call these modes, the columns of U, the U's, and these are often called the loadings in engineering literature. And clearly the magnitude of the singular value tells me how important that mode is in reconstructing my data. So the important thing is, in lots of these things, is how do I stack up my matrix X? If I want to do this singular, this simple singular value decomposition, I need to understand that my data needs to be somehow stacked so that it has some physical significance. Now, actually, I didn't know about all these nice dimensionality, the sort of intrinsic dimension extraction techniques, which could be really very useful. So what I, of course, if I set all my singular values to zero, which are small, I can reconstruct my data with very small number of modes. Okay, so only the first P, columns of U and V. This is all standard stuff. Okay, so let me give an example. So the first example, so I am using completely standard SVD, which is effectively, I'm saying I'm standard SVD, but of course it could be PCA or ICA as well. But the basic idea of dimensionality reduction into these modes. So the first application is non-invasive lung function monitoring. So if any of you have got asthma or any breathing difficulties, you may have done a spirometer test where you're asked to breathe. So you breathe, you can breathe normally, and then they ask you to fill your lungs and exhale as quickly as possible. Now, the only slight problem with this is people who have COPD, bronchiolitis, children, old people, can't actually do spirometer tests. And a lot of people find it very, very difficult to breathe into this spirometer. So this came about a long time ago by somebody coming to me and saying, well, look, there's this Italian group who do motion capture. And one of the other things I do is motion capture. I have a multiple camera system. I do 3D reconstruction. And he said, can't we put a baby with lots of markers on, get the cameras round, and look at the chest? They've shown that you can look at the breathing. So we said, well, forget it, because A, these are very expensive, and B, taking them in somewhere, calibrating them, someone knocks them, you calibrate them again, you know, it's a complete non-starter. So we set up something in the lab, which is basically a pre-connect, a little projector, two cameras, this transmuted into something which you could wipe clean, and we called it structured light plethysmography, SLP. So this company called Numacare, who now market this, has been very slow getting off the ground. But basically, we wanted to do something which, something which was completely and utterly robust. I'm having a few problems with my videos. Right, so we project the chessboard, look at it from two cameras. Chessboard is really easy to pick up corners. Put some effort in. So this algorithm is on the web, so people can download it. It works under creases and basically a chessboard projected onto any surface, even if it's discontinuous, and it matches. So we have this really robust algorithm. We chose chessboard because it's very easy. It's basically does the same as a Kinect, but it's much more accurate. Okay. Now the Kinect has changed since we did this. The Kinect has changed to be a time-of-flight camera. This was in the days where the Kinect would project little infrared dots, and it would look at them with two cameras. So this is we can get sub-millimeter accuracy because you're only about this far away. So basically what we're able to do is, now there's a slight error here, but what we're doing is we're actually integrating that moving surface to form volumes. So we can see, I might have to, so this is the breathing pattern I get. This is time frame or sample number versus volume. This is just the derivative. This is volume versus flow. So the derivative is flow. And this little, if I'll push this along a bit. It's going to do a for, this is called a force maneuver when you breathe in. So, of course, these are not exact volumes. What we're looking for is the shape. So you breathe in, you force it all out, and what you get is this flow volume loop. And what doctors look at is actually the form of this flow volume loop. So you can indeed do some classification on purely on the flow volume loop. So it's nice, completely non-invasive way. And we can do lots of interesting things with this. So we get an accurate estimate of the chest, abdomen, wall moving over time. And both for force maneuvers, tidal breathing. Tidal breathing is just when you're breathing normally. So it opens up the possibility of doing long function evaluation just on tidal breathing, which everybody can do, otherwise it'd be dead. So we started to think about how we could characterize this tidal breathing in terms of surfaces. So we've verified that it gives the same shape as spirometry, but what we can do is we've got structure in this. We can do regional analysis, and the spirometer, of course, can't. So, you know, if I plotted the total volume versus the abdominal versus thoracic volumes, you can see slightly different phases, you see slightly different volumes. Some people use their diaphragm much more than others. So you can get all kinds of information just from something like this. But what we've also done is actually decomposing this data. So this breathing data is a four-dimensional data set, effectively. And the decomposition that works best, so I can actually stack my data in all kinds of ways. So the way that works best is a mapping of the grid position to the position time space. Okay, so I have my grid that maps to a surface which moves over time. So I can stack my data in many ways, but this is, if I want to think about, it's a mapping of surfaces to surfaces. So I will stack it this way. So what, and I can then check, so what I can do is I can do my decomposition. Strange projection of the original. This would be my reconstruction using the first two singular values, the first two modes. So all I'm getting is its orientation and space. If I take four of them, I get something which is almost identical. And so the higher modes of these surfaces just give me little ripples. So now, of course, it's quite hard to get a lot of data, because there aren't many of these systems about, and also actually just getting it into trials is quite tough. So but what from the data we have, it appears that normal tidal breathing seems to be characterized by a large degree of variability in the time between individual breaths. That's just, you can do that with a spirometer, and a surface motion that can be characterized by very few of these eigensurfaces. So I'll call them eigensurfaces. Asthma, COPD, etc., these problems with problematic breathing, seems to be characterized by a very low variance between the individual breaths. So people are not able to be as variable as normal breathing. But a more complex combination of these eigensurfaces is needed to build up the breathing pattern. Okay, so it's kind of early days, but there's some patterns emerging. Now, a slight problem with this is very, like you take the Blues boat, big, or the rugby team, big sort of strong rowers or rugby players, then they look more like these people, strangely, than normal people. So sort of highly trained people tend to be somewhere in the middle. Okay, so that was one example. The other example is motion analysis. And we have, as I said, I look at motion capture. So one of the applications is rehabilitation in people or in dogs. We have in Cambridge, we have the world's foremost authority in dog knee replacements at the vet school. So they do a lot of dog knee replacements and want to look at gait. So our aim was to try to characterize gait. We'd like to automatically fit skeletons to motion capture data, lots of markers moving around. This is marked motion capture, not connect like motion capture, because only with markers can you get really, you can get the rotations of the joints accurately. Connect, you just can't do it. We'd like to fit an accurate skeleton with a very minimal marker set, and we'd like to sort of, can we break it down into some modes where I can characterize gait? Okay, it may be able to distinguish gait. Stroke is a difficult one because you can get so little data, but there are other applications. So, for example, here is an example of what I mean by motion capture. This was one of my former PhD students. So you put lots of markers on. You have, I think this was a six or eight camera system. You calibrate your system, you triangulate, you get your markers, you get your 3D marker positions in real time. So you put them on the limbs, so somehow from those markers, you can work out the joints, okay? So lots of different, what I've got here is markers, end markers, and three positions, X, Y, Z, over time. So that's what my motion capture spits out. If I just play it back and join them up, I get this. So yes, he does enjoy doing this. So what we were looking at was saying, right, okay, what if I wanted an eigen trajectory, what would it be? So let me say position of marker M in frame F is given by this. So the trajectory of marker M would be an F times 3 vector of frames. So I could write it like that. So let me stack up my trajectories for each marker, like that, and do an SVD. So somehow I'm going to get some modes which are important for my motion. So question is, what, you know, so I can easily reconstruct my motion and see how well this works. So this eigen trajectory space would be the column space of that T matrix, and then the thought is any of my trajectories can be built up from a linear combination of these eigen trajectories. Now, what we are doing is we're using this idea for estimating the joints in a different space. Okay, I won't go into that, but this reduced space seems to give us a good, and also for smoothing trajectories as well. But that's a kind of, it's a data analysis application. But if I show you, I mean, it's really quite interesting. So if I show you, what I get with just the first one. So if I just reconstruct it with one singular value, I get just the general one-dimensional direction of him dancing about. That's what you might expect. This is not very exciting. So if I do this one, now I've got a kind of two-dimensional. It's rather better. So you can kind of see that it's getting there. So how many do I need? He's not looking too healthy. So let me play you the reconstruction with five. So five gives me, yeah, almost. So as soon as I've gone to five, I've almost got everything. And there is 48 or so. So the question is then, can we actually get, can we classify, can we use these eigentrajectories to classify motion and see whether people's motions change? Because it's the important ways of moving. You can certainly use it to pick out one person from another if they're walking. But basically, you can do that other ways as well. Gait is a very, very particular, something which is very particular to people. Okay, so Andreas, who actually did this, is still working on this now. So we've been doing this for quite a long time. Most of the work we started with was actually extracting accurate joints for people, because we think we have a method for doing this very accurately, given these markers. But then, the medical data that we've got at the moment seems to be very large, multiple one-dimensional data sets, normally consisting of long time series for many subjects and patients, EEG, ECG, PSG, SpO2, etc. So you get lots of this, and it's big business. So there's a site called PhysioNet, which some of you may know about, and that runs a competition every year. So it has data sets which you have to classify. So it has training, validation, and test sets. And you can submit your algorithm and see if you win. So see if you get the best classification. So it classifies the training set for you. So for example, in ECG, you will have people with different sorts of heart conditions. So I'm going to just look at something one of my students has been doing, which is one form of machine learning called recurrent neural networks. So it's now just interesting, the methods which seem to have the maximum success in previous competitions are those which do some extraction, handcrafted extraction of features from the data, then push it through a neural net of some sort. They're the best performing ones at the moment. So recurrent neural nets, what are they? So the most simple form of recurrent neural net is something like this, which I've adapted from Lipton 2015. This is a kind of hand-wavy description, but you know, I have my input, I have my hidden layers, or layer. Indeed, we only use one hidden layer. But this is deep learning, which people classify it as deep learning for reasons I'll say, and we have the output. But in recurrent neural nets, these hidden layer units, the green ones, can be connected between contiguous time steps. They can be connected, and also input can be fed in this per time step manner. Okay, so because you have this connection between the hidden layers, RNNs are generally seen as deep learning, even though they haven't got many, many layers. Normally it's five layers for deep learning in a normal neural net. Okay, so we're going to use these. And these have given particularly good results for time series, as you can imagine, because of this feedback and forward between the hidden layers over time. Now, the big problem with RNNs is that they're actually pretty hard to see what it's doing. Uninterpretable black boxes is what people call them. But it's certainly in medicine, it really is important to understand what your machine learning technique is doing. So somehow you would like, this is why the best techniques at the moment still do this data dimensionality reduction in some way and feed it into the neural net. So can we, what we've been trying to look at is if these neural nets can actually sort out themselves, these recurrent neural nets. So my student, Jos van der Westhuizen, has just submitted a paper, put it on archive, where he's looking at these visualization techniques. So I'll just show you, give you a little idea, I've got time, about what he's doing. So it's basically trying to understand what the neural net is doing in its own dimensionality reduction world. So what features are important? So what he's been doing is to say, well, why don't I just occlude bits of my input and see how it changes the output? Okay, so this, and then, so if I do that, I can get some predictive score, which I can sum over the iterations, somehow normalize, and I can get some kind of heat map telling me which are the most important regions. Now, I'm going to show an example of this because it's really nice on actually this MNIST handwritten digit data set. And we didn't start on this, it's a nice little example because it's not a time series, but nevertheless, I'll show you. So the ideas of doing this came from convolutional neural nets and the way people try to understand what convolutional neural nets are doing when they're looking at images by looking at kind of what filter responses they produce at each level. I don't know whether you've done any CNNs. So it's quite impressive. You know, you start to understand what filters they're applying at each level of the hidden layers. So what this is now, so you have the MNIST data set are lots and lots of handwritten characters. I think someone else had some handwritten characters. I don't know whether it was from this data set because they look similar. So you have 0 to 9, and so we ran the recurrent neural net. It classified these, this is just for one sample of each, illustrative, but we run it for lots. The neural net that the RNN we're actually using is called an LSTM, which is long short-term memory. So this, we have 5x5 blocks. We occlude them one by one, and then we build up this importance map of how important that block is. So effectively with this, it seems fairly obvious that what the RNN is looking at are the bits where there is nothing. The large bits where there's no digit. For example, here, it's all the bit around the 5, especially at the top, all the bit around the 0, bits around the 1, bits around the 3. So when we saw this, we thought, oh, okay, so if we can sort of visually interpret this and think, okay, that's what it's doing, that might enable me to handcraft my features, you know, so that I help the neural net. And these things like take days and days to run. So the more help you can give it at the outset, the better. They clog up everyone's machine and they run for days. So so could we apply this to medical time series? So this is an example of ECG. Again, I can only kind of show you one sample of each. These, you probably can't read them. These are different types of heartbeat classified in the PhysioNet dataset. So it's normal, left bundle branch, right bundle branch, pace, and ventricular fibrillation. So kind of able to have a look. Now we're not sort of too sure about this yet, but because we need to run it on lots and lots of samples and aggregate them. But you can sort of see that clearly in the right Bundle Branch Beat, you're getting these little wiggles here, which are very characteristic, are the important things. Here, this seems to be the important thing, etc. Okay, so what we're hoping to do is to use these neural nets to tell and medical data to go back and say, well, what's the important part of my input data that it needs, what's it picking out as important? So if I can help it at the beginning to pick out these important things, I will say oodles of time. All these are classified correctly. But it's a very difficult data set because it's got noise, really noisy ones, and they're very difficult to classify. So another thing which we're just looking at, which could be useful, it may not be useful, we'll see. So look at how the classification changes over time. This is a long one. So let me just do this. So this would be the heat classes, and this is the most likely class. So it goes from 0, 1, 2, 3, from blue up to brown. And this starts to change at some point. So it always starts off wrong, and then at some point it changes. And it always ends up at the right class, but at some point it kind of suddenly flips from one class to another, and then it will eventually obtain the right class. Okay, so we can do things like this once we've got everything up and running. Takes a long time, this. We can do things like this. We can do it on, this one didn't work before, so I think it needs media player and I can't seem to get it to run. Anyway, we can do the same thing with my time series, let it go along, and at what point does it say, yes, I've got that classification right? So we're hoping that with the two sort of approaches to this, we'll be able to perhaps do initial dimensionality reduction, which we are also hoping will help our generalization. Because it's a massive problem not being able to generalize. If I take data in one hospital and then get some from another hospital, usually it falls in a heap. So just to summarize, so almost all of my data needs pre-processing before any form of classification. And that's one of the big things about this. It's difficult to know exactly what you need to do to different data sets. We found that taking modal structures is really useful. It's an effective way of feature extraction, which can be used for prediction, classification, diagnosis maybe. But also, lots of people are looking at visualizing what these neural networks do for images and for time series. And if we can sort of understand what they do when they learn, then hopefully we'll get better generalization and better performance. And still, these handcrafted features put into machine learning algorithms still outdo all the straightforward machine learning techniques at the moment. In any given competition on these PhysioNet and sites, you never quite know what the winner does until they then publish their paper. So, but the papers are published fairly quickly after the competition. Okay, I finished a little bit early. Thank you.
Yes.
So for example, if you zero mean your data, so some of these medical data sets, the amplitudes can vary. But if it's a shape that is actually important, if you don't normalize them, say zero mean and change the standard deviation or maximum and minimum, put it to a set range, then you get very different results. And it depends, is the amplitude important? Or is it just the shape that's important? With the breathing data, it is pretty much the shape.
Is this a general thing that appears when you classify shapes like these digits or something like this, that what is picked up is the shape in terms of the spare? What is spared out? Is this?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's interesting.
Yes.
Because I didn't expect that to come out at all.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It'd be interesting to sort of look at what people have done on the convolutional neural nets to see what filters they've got.
I suppose I think look more like pieces of digits, at least after a couple of layers. So I think that, you know,
CNN.
This is a different way of probing what they're picking up. So the information can be really different.
Yes.
And so it's an extra dimension of information about what is being picked up. So.
Yes.
You test the variability of this heat map if you change the person who is writing. So, I mean...
So the MNIST data set is, correct me if I'm wrong if anyone knows, a whole heap of characters from different people.
Okay.
Now, what we haven't done though, you're absolutely right, is we haven't done it over all samples to see if sometimes this doesn't happen. Yeah, I don't know. In fact, I have to say, so Jos did that video, did those pictures. Well, we've submitted it to NIPS, and so we had that picture. But I said, could you do lots of pictures for me, just so we can see them? And he said, no, he's ill. So, we've done a few. James,
when you So you train your neural nets, and then you essentially handcraft the data to speed up the processing.
Well, we don't, but that's what we'd like to do.
Oh, yeah. That's the idea.
Yeah.
What will happen, or what do you think will happen, if you then retrain the neural nets on the handcrafted data? Will it actually give you the same response functions, or will that actually change? How stable is that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, because at the moment we haven't actually done any handcrafting at all, but I know that if we looked at the winner of last year's PhysioNet challenge, that certainly did it, and I don't know whether they went back and actually tested that or not.
At the beginning of your talk, you had different data modalities, and so you can analyze them, of course, separately, but you can also consider, when you have more than one at the same time.
Of course.
So have you looked at that and how to make the different data modalities communicate with each other?
No, not really. And that's what I would think is a sort of Bayesian data fusion problem, which is really quite interesting. So for I know for image segmentation, for example, there's some people who are doing lots of fusion, not only with with lines and inches and things like that. I mean, I have the thing where I have used lots of different things is in camera calibration, where I use points and lines and sections of planes and things like that. That's really quite tough because you've got to get your metrics correct and all weighted properly. But no, we haven't done that. It's quite hard getting all the data on one particular person.
Right. All right, let's thank our speaker.
Thanks. Thank you.